Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 3:34 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is April 14th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I saw this graphic earlier on this week, and I thought it was particularly relevant because there's a huge debate going on about renewable energy. But it's as plain as day that when you look at rich countries and electricity consumption, that there's no such thing as a low energy rich country. So you can either have less electricity and less income, or more electricity, more income. Well, there are two ways of thinking about it. It's either that in order to generate high income, you need a lot of electricity, or because you generate a lot of income, you use a lot of electricity. So it's either a living standard result, or it's a result of needing electricity to create the income. And it's probably a bit of both. As living standards improve, there's more demand for power, electricity, and all forms of energy. So as we then think about where is the world going? What is the main talking point for just about every politician in the world today? Well, it's about energy and energy policy and carbon emissions, climate change, and where the money is going to come from to pioneer an entirely new energy infrastructure. So obviously, these are significant topics, but then it's also worth, I think, considering that oil prices continue to hover here around the $80 area. So we've been in this range that has extended from $20 to $140 now for about 15 years. And this is, I think, also particularly relevant to look at the very long term. So there is an historic chart that gives us oil prices that go all the way back to the late 1800s. And what it graphically represents is that oil prices have tended over time to travel in ranges. Now, we had a profound dislocation during the pandemic, so the price dipped down into the underlying range. But what we can also very clearly see is that there have been several occasions over the course of the last century when oil prices took a step change higher over the course of a decade and then subsequently ranged at a higher level that had previously been unimaginable before the breakout. So it does then beg the question, are we going to see another breakout in the near term? Now, on this chart, it's a monthly chart, it's 200 months. So that moving average doesn't really make a lot of sense on that kind of basis. But if we were to change it to 60 months, then we're going to get, I think, more information here, just in terms of longer term trends. So when we adjust that moving average, go all the way back out and look at that, all that back history, well, we can see that there's a broad swing. And generally speaking, the times when the price is not only trading above the moving average, but trending above it, that has generally coincided with significant bull markets. So now the price is hovering around the $80 level. Now, this is only updated monthly, so it doesn't quite incorporate current prices, but it is likely that this area could be a potential area of support. So there are lots of competing arguments. One would be that there's no money being spent on the kind of exploration and investment in new infrastructure required to significantly boost supply. Now, this is not like 20 years ago. It's not like we have to go out and find a lot of new oil. I think everybody pretty much understands where the oil is, and the unexplored areas are all offshore. So exploration offshore is very much dependent on prices staying higher for longer, because the vast majority of new supply depends on rates that are somewhere between about $40 and $50 a barrel, but then reach higher than that depending on the location. So prices at $80 are not really at the point where it's going to encourage a lot of investment in new supply. So that's limiting. That's a limiting factor, and it is giving power back to the producers, which are primarily OPEC and Russia. Now, of course, there's always a different way of thinking about it, and the fact that the USA is now a major energy exporter, both oil and natural gas, then that does change the calculus. But what it effectively does is turn what the country that had previously been the biggest consumer into a competitor of those other producers. And that also suggests that the US has a vested interest in prices staying somewhat higher, because now it's an export commodity, and obviously that's an important factor. Now, then there's the additional question, because when we look at global demand for oil, well, all of the demand growth is coming from emerging markets, and the demand coefficient for the developed markets peaked about a decade ago. So, regardless of what happens, all growth in demand is going to happen somewhere else. And that basically means the emerging markets, which are Asia and Africa primarily. Now, if we don't see a lot of new money going into boosting supply, and we continue to see demand in the emerging markets continuing higher, then what would basically be the mitigating factor would be a collapse in demand from developed markets. So we did see that the Environmental Protection Agency in the USA, they announced new, very strict tailpipe emission rules for internal combustion engines, and those are going to go into effect by 2030. And that's, of course, assuming that it's not reneged upon by the next government. And in Europe, the carbon emissions price is currently holding around €95, so down a bit in here today. It has not quite yet broken higher, but these are sustainably higher prices and definitely politically motivated. So we're definitely getting a lot more interference of government in the energy sector, and there is a clear intention to try and stop using oil altogether. And there's an equally large public campaign to stop using gas, most particularly for home heating and cooking. Now, I know in my household, at least, having invested in a 35,000 BTU wok hob a couple of years ago, the term prying it from my cold, dead hands has certainly been voiced in this household. I think there is certainly a lot of discussion on the way about the role of natural gas in the home. But then you have the fact that natural gas prices are exceptionally low. So there has been an incredible bounty of new natural gas supply coming into the market, and the price is really only just beginning to steady from the lower side of the range. Now, there are frighteningly few occasions when natural gas prices have traded below $2 over the last 15 years. So What that also suggests is that we're probably in the region of a significant low, because natural gas is in fact the only commodity that completely unwound the big bull market, and it is now back in the region of the lows that presided before the big commodity bull market. So then let's look at what that means for Europe. So European natural gas prices have also come down in a meaningful fashion and are below the 1,000-day moving average and weakening back down towards the 50 euro area. Now, that has not unwound the big bull market. And we've had higher prices for gas in Europe generally. And there is still significant potential for volatility because it was an unseasonably warm winter. The reserves finished at historically high levels. They'll start buying, but they have the opportunity to buy on weakness now. They can be more price sensitive in terms of buying. So that should contribute to some strength in the price. It's unlikely that the price is going to go all the way back down to the lows before the big swing up ahead of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But the peak at 300 is likely a secular peak. We're unlikely to see that again for a significant period of time. Now, when we think about where growth is going to come from, what is the benign solution? Well, we need cheaper energy. And electrification does appear to be the big bet that politicians have made. So they want to stop using gasoline, diesel, stop burning coal, stop using gas, and they want to electrify the entire global economy. And that's inordinately expensive. So it means that there's going to have to be huge investment in electricity generating capacity. So, NextEra Energy is an example of a company that has been spending a ton of money on expansion, and that has allowed it to become the largest constituent of the utilities index. So, then just looking at their financials. Well, what we can clearly see is that they have had negative free cash flow for basically an indefinite period, and the market cap has gone up considerably. Debt has gone up about 50% in the last 5 years, and revenue has gone up, but not as much. So it's a leveraged company. And they continue to leverage up, but the share price is going sideways. So one of the big questions then is if all this money is going to be spent on reorienting the global economy towards electrification. That was easy to talk about when interest rates were zero. And how is it going to be funded when interest rates have gone up substantially? So, NextEra Energy has invested in a lot of wind and solar, and they have nuclear, and then they have been borrowing money to pay for all of that. And the price today is exactly where it was in late 2020, and it's pausing in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, it does beg the question that when you have a utility that is trading on an estimated PE of 25 and has a PE, excuse me, has a price to sales ratio of 7.4 and is trading on nearly 4 times its book value, then is that price justifiable? Well, it obviously then begs the question, what's going to happen with interest rates? And that, of course, also comes through to the other big question. How are the debts that have been accumulated during the pandemic going to be funded? And the interest rate expense, or the interest expense on the outstanding debt, continues to increase as it is refinanced, and the US government, more than any other major government, has got a short duration on that debt. And of course, many investors have been wondering why they didn't stretch the maturities on the debt. But then, of course, there's also the other side of it, is that bond investors weren't willing to buy that longer dated debt. And they weren't willing to stretch out those maturities because they didn't trust the government to be responsible with all the money that they were borrowing. So inflationary pressures are still higher than anyone is really comfortable with. This is the CPI Core Services ex shelter year over year. Now, it is coming down, but it's coming down a lot slower than it went up. So we're down to about 5.72%. And prior to the big breakout in late 2021, this index traded around 2%, but spent most of its time between 2 and 3%. We can't really say that inflation has been got under control until that starts to come back down. Now, there are two arguments here as well. So we have this big question in energy about the what I think I would distill that question of energy down to efficiency. We are substituting efficiency for carbon mitigation, and that necessarily means that it's going to be less efficient. And if it's less efficient, then it means duplication. It means that there's going to be more cost involved. That means that people are going to have to pay more. It's inflationary in nature. Now let's think about what it's going to take to get inflation back under control. Well, on the one hand, there are parts of the economy where prices are inflating, and there's not a lot that central banks can do about that. Now, if they decide to continue to tighten, then what's very likely is there'll be a deep recession. So the Federal Reserve has two mandates. They can, as what they basically are doing, is trying to create the illusion of stable prices and then supporting full employment. And those are the two mandates. So at present, they are not pressured in attempting to control inflation because unemployment has not moved. So the only thing that is going to stop them from continuing to raise rates would be if unemployment spikes higher. Now, the other big question then is, would they sacrifice the battle against inflation because of weakening economic potential? And will they attempt to fine-tune their policy and wait a while to simply see whether the long lag of tightening monetary policy is going to then contribute to less growth? So, will they try and ensure that there is a soft landing by stopping raising rates now? So, the stock market has been willing to bet that they would take option two, that they would stop raising rates soon, and that has helped to contain the 3-month yield. So it is hovering here around 5%. And the Fed funds rate is at 5%. Well, the upper bound is at 5%. So the 3-month yield is pricing in the potential that the lower bound will be at 5% in a couple of weeks' time. What we started to see today was investors beginning to price in the potential that the May hike will not be the last hike. So the S&P 500 was in mildly negative territory, but then recouped much of that loss. And it is hovering here in the region of the February high. Now, I think that it is very difficult to argue that a recession can be avoided. But we're not yet at a point where a recession has started, and unemployment has not yet started to rise. What we have definitely seen, though, is that the number of job openings has started to decline. So it just makes, I think, common sense to think that whenever the number of job openings declines, then a company would naturally stop hiring before they start firing. And that suggests to me that unemployment rising is something that we will see later on this year. Now, we might not see two consecutive quarters of recession until 2024, but we'll probably see the first quarter of a contraction in 2023. Now, something that I think is most particularly important is that M2 is negative. So when we look at the year-over-year figure, we've had this incredible surge in money supply growth in 2020, and not only has that been fully unwound, but now the money is coming back out. So from a monetarist perspective, then that's likely to be anti-inflationary. We should anticipate that inflationary pressures will mitigate, and that ultimately what we will be presiding over is deflationary pressures. But bond yields remained really quite steady. Now, I think it is also particularly relevant that we have very deeply inverted yield curves, and so far it is not yet pushing up. And it is not generally until the yield curve spread is pushing up through the zero bound that we see a clear pricing in of downward potential into stock markets. So we're still in this what I would consider to be the eye of the storm. That I do not believe that we have seen the extent of the selling pressure. So we could quite easily see some additional upside. We have higher reaction lows, we've broken the downtrend, and we could see the price ranging around here between 3,500 and 4,500 for another few months. And of course, that is on the assumption that it can actually push up through the high from a few months ago. The potential, though, is that we're going to see all of this interest rate hiking and negative money supply growth, quantitative tightening, and tightness in the banking sector, feeding through into lower economic potential. What I thought was especially interesting today was the divergence in the performance of the S&P 500 Banks Index, which was up and led by the net interest income from JP Morgan. So the share gapped higher in trading this morning. That's a very emphatic rebound. But JP Morgan has been successful in attracting deposits, but it's at the expense of the regional banks index. So the regional banks dropped down in here today. So what this is very clearly stating is that the regional banks are under duress, that they are losing deposits, and that a lot of that money is going to money market funds, but some of it at least is going into the larger banks like Citigroup, Bank of America, and JP Morgan. And they were all among the leading advancers in here today on the S&P 500 Banks Index. But that's happening at the expense of the smaller banks. And that means that there's going to be less credit availability in the real economy. So That's this is an additional sign of a potential contraction later. Now, then I think it's it does beg the question that we have these very large debt issues, and there is an acute need for productivity growth. So there's been a big surge of interest in NVIDIA as one of the key beneficiaries of artificial intelligence. Now, the share is a bit overbought in the short term. It could pull back by $60 and still be in the region of the 200-day moving average. So I don't think this is an environment where chasing is going to be productive. And artificial intelligence is improving in leaps and bounds, and investors are willing to bet that it will be a viable productivity enhancer. Now, if that is indeed the case, well, that should help to mitigate some of the debt issues if we get higher productivity. And if we get recessions, well, then some of the inflationary pressures will mitigate and we'll have some deflationary forces. But it does also raise the specter, perhaps, of stagflation, where you get higher unemployment and high inflation. So the continued strength of the oil market is a part of that. And this is obviously something that investors need to be aware of. But what we're also now starting to see is continued strength in copper. And copper prices bounced quite emphatically yesterday and gave up a little bit of the advance in here today. But this is still holding the region of the 200-day moving average. Electrification is basically substituting oil demand for copper demand. And that the trend, such as we see so far, is supportive of a mild demand-dominated environment. We're certainly not seeing the kind of strongly, quickly trending environment that we had in 2020 through to the first quarter or second quarter of 2021. And copper prices are holding higher for somewhat longer. Now, when we think about the copper miners, well, they are strengthening. So the GlobalX Copper Miners ETF has popped up from the region of the 200-day moving average, and it's at the upper side of this range that's been forming for 2 years. And this has the hallmark of a first step above the base. So there was a profound and deep downtrend between 2011 and 2016. And I think it is quite relevant to highlight that the gold miners ETF has a really quite similar trajectory, where we get this big downtrend between 2011 and 2016, a big rebound and subsequent ranging. Now, the gold miners ETF has rebounded in very emphatic fashion, and it's a bit overbought in the short term, and we saw some profit taking coming through in here today, but it was well off the low by the end of trading. And then we had gold prices pulling back by almost $40 and also closing off the low, and still holding the $2,000 area, but we are overbought in the short term, and it did race to get up to this level. So there is the potential that we do get some pause and consolidation. And the bull market for gold is very much entwined with the argument for a weaker dollar and negative real interest rates. And that is also very much tied to the argument for a stagflationary environment or potentially financial repression. And we've definitely seen examples of governments interfering in the credit issuance decisions of the banking sector. And we've seen governments leaping to support the banking sector in times of strife, which we saw with Credit Suisse going under, and the Swiss government breaking contract law. Then we've seen the exact same thing with the US government being very swift in basically guaranteeing all deposits. That's basically putting the full force of the US government behind deposits. I can't help but think that there's a geopolitical element to a lot of what is going on right now. And if it were to be framed as a national security effort to ensure that there is enough backup power, that we need to electrify because there will be an acute need for oil capacity to be exported to friendly countries, and that this investment in electrification is totally necessary as a precautionary measure, then I think there would be a lot less discussion about, or I think debate about whether it was necessary or not. But what is clear is that the US, the Federal Reserve so far is raising rates in order to try and get inflationary pressures lower. And they have not yet stopped raising rates. And there's the possibility that the next one is the last one, but that in order for that to happen, we would need to see inflationary pressures coming down and economic activity moderating and unemployment starting to rise, or at least jobless figures continuing to trend higher. And initial jobless claims, it's a volatile measure, but it is trending higher. Now, it hasn't broken out in a big way, but it has broken out, and it is back above the 200-day moving average. Now, of course, because of the spike that we had in the pandemic, it is, I think, worth highlighting that prior to the pandemic, we did have higher reaction lows, and we'd had an initial spike higher. I remain very much of the view that a recession was looking very likely in 2020, and subsequently valuations exploded with the quantity of money being printed. So there is, I think, an order of operations. We're likely first to see a peak in interest rates, and then subsequently we'll see unemployment rising. And then there will be a monetary and fiscal response in order to offset the potential for recessions. Then, subsequently, that money is going to inflate asset prices again. So, I think maybe the yield curve spread gives us a clue to what we should expect, because we did have a lower high. But now the Federal Reserve and other central banks have a lot of room to cut without going all the way back down to zero. And I suspect that that is what we will see, that we could see the Federal Reserve cut interest rates by 300 basis points. And that would be well above the zero bound. So, if we do see the yield curve spread moving upwards, I think it is likely that we will get a wide spread. That will then help to recapitalize the banking sector. But there will probably also be an element of financial repression, because all of this debt that exists today is going to increase if we have a recession and there is going to be a lot more support. So that is why gold has rallied, because investors are willing to bet that we might not be seeing a lot of money printing now, but the dollar index has rolled over. And that's supportive for gold. And then there's clearly the potential that when there is a recession, then money printing is going to explode. And of course, that is an equal reason why Bitcoin is also rallying. So over this week, it has pushed up through the 30,000 level for the first time in almost a year. And we are 1 year away from the halving. And prior to halvenings, we get a big rally from deeply depressed levels. Then prices moderate. And we actually saw Bitcoin pulling back and unwinding almost all of the advance in 2019. And then after the halving, it took a while, but then prices really started to take off in late 2020. And I think that it is very likely we're going to see a similar pattern of behavior on this occasion. But it is worth highlighting that there has tended to be about a 4 year cycle in terms of the supply of monetary accommodation. And that would suggest then that we're going to see a big upswing in monetary accommodation in 2024, and that is quite likely to coincide with a recession. So what we're seeing right now is a rebound in risk assets, and the Nasdaq is continuing to hover here around the 13,000 level, and it has broken the sequence of lower rally highs. But with a recession around the corner, then it's unlikely that the price is going to get back up to the peak from 2021, and instead, that I think a more likely scenario is ranging, and that the surprises are more likely to be on the downside. As we look out over the course of the next decade, then I think interference by governments in the banking sector is virtually inevitable. There is a vast sea of debt, and ensuring that everybody pays back their debts and the unfunded liabilities of lots of governments are held good, then it suggests that there's going to be a lot of lending that banks are told to do. And we've seen examples of that. But I think the geopolitical element is something that is going to come to the fore because China is now actively looking to increase the role of the renminbi in the global economy. So the euro is at about 30%, and the dollar is in excess of 50%. And a few years ago, the renminbi was lower than 7%. But just in the last week, they signed deals with TotalEnergies for LNG imports to be in renminbi. Now that the socialist Lula da Silva is back in charge of Brazil, Brazil will be accepting renminbi for oil exports. Ghana has also signed a deal with China. Now, of course, they also have been going through a sovereign default and they need whatever money they can get. But China is definitely more involved in trying to internationalize the currency. And then all of that is happening at the same time that the Federal Reserve is ready to start its FedNow payments system. So they look like what they're going to do is streamline payments to, I think, offset some of the risk of the cryptocurrency market making them obsolete without, in fact, adopting cryptocurrencies. And that is, I think, something that is going to weigh on the blockchain sector. And we can think, for example, about Block, where it has pulled right back down and is back in the region of the lows. And this is despite the fact that they pinned hopes for the growth of the company on their payments network. And also, they don't hold a lot of Bitcoin, but they had certainly decided that they were going to rename their company Blockchain Block instead of just simply fixing with their biggest acquisition, which was Cash App. So there's certainly a lot of moving parts, and China is attempting to circumvent the US control of the global financial sector. De-dollarization is insignificant in terms of global trade so far, but the trend of travel is quite clear, and they're likely to succeed in boosting, perhaps doubling or even tripling, the role of the renminbi in the global economy. And China is far and away the biggest trading partner of most of the emerging markets. So I think that there is very clearly the potential that we're going to have a more fraught geopolitical environment, and that will require a lot of resources being mobilized to duplicate manufacturing capacity and to also revitalize domestic infrastructure, or there will be inshoring, nearshoring, friendshoring. And I think those are very important trends. We've said for years that India was our favorite market for the long term, and the Nifty index has rebounded and has now broken the short-term sequence of lower rally highs. It is likely to be among the biggest beneficiaries of the migration of manufacturing capacity away from China. And not only that, but it has a larger and younger population than China. So then it is only really a question of how those people can be mobilized and their productive capacity enhanced. And I think that is probably going to be one of the big evolutions over the course of the next decade, that there will be a lot more manufacturing taking place in India simply as a matter of necessity. As we then think about the decades going forward, well, productivity growth is intrinsically tied with electricity. So fusion reactors have long been promised, but the timelines for those promises is getting shorter. And then the other side of the equation is longevity, and more people are living longer, and that is one of the factors that has contributed to population growth. And more young children are surviving into adulthood, and that's also contributing to the growth of the global population. But there are clear trends of fertility rates collapsing in several countries, and once they start to decline, they never recover. There's the clear potential that the global economy is going to be looking at a post-growth environment in about 30 years, and that the growth that we get from ever more people isn't going to be a factor any longer. And that will throw much more focus onto the individual productivity of every individual. And then that is also something that is contributing to more interest in robotics and artificial intelligence. So I think that is certainly something that has the potential to be one of the bigger investment trends over the course of the next decade, as the that eventuality is eventually more effectively priced in. Then we can think about the ability of the big global companies to prosper in that environment. Because as long as they are investing in line with government ambitions, and the fact that they employ large numbers of people around the world, and that they can move their capital around to the most attractive locations, that's likely to be really quite beneficial to the banking sector, to the autonomies more generally, to the dividend aristocrats. And the Dividend Aristocrats ETF continues to hover here and has been ranging now for 2 years. I think that we are looking at a significant big bull market in gold, that Financial repression is the reality that at the moment inflation is the number one concern, but that in due course deflation will take over. We'll see a big swing in terms of the money printed that's going to enhance the appeal of limited supply alternative assets like gold or Bitcoin or art, coins, fine wine, and indeed property in choice locations. And of course, if interest rates come back down, then that is also likely to create upward pressure on the housing market. And houses are beginning to, or the setback we've seen in the housing market is not quite over, but with mortgage rates started to come back down, then that is helping to support demand. Now, in somewhere like the UK, where there's a lot of 2-year fixes are going to have to refinance this year. It's about 40,000 people every month have to refix into significantly higher rates. Well, that is one of the mitigating factors behind the Bank of England raising rates, that it's going to contain the ability of the central bank to raise rates. But then, of course, the big question is how is the government going to react in terms of all of those wage demands? And it really does bring home the fact that large numbers of public sector employees have a huge power over government policy. So, in the countries where they have more government employees, then they are going to have a much harder time dictating where money goes and what prices are paid. And it is going to be a sticky factor in terms of inflationary pressures. But even then, the fact is that the pound is rebounding. Now, it hasn't pushed up through the 125 level yet, but it's pausing here and it's a little overbought in the short term. And the dollar was a little steadier in here today, but the dollar is very long in the tooth. And when we look at the dollar index, it has tended to move in 7-year cycles, and it's overdue a significant decline. And if it does break lower, and this is the beginning of a new 7-year bearish cycle, well, then it could trend down for the next 7 years, which would take us out to 2030. Now, if that's the case, then gold is going to explode on the upside. If we really do get a negative real interest rate environment and the constant maturity real 10-year has paused and is quite likely peaking now. So if this starts to become progressively more inverted, that's the missing ingredient for a big bull market in gold. So there is certainly the potential that what we're looking at right now is a change in terms of the secular trend. And I'm looking for my, let me see if I can do this. And I look at the NASDAQ oil chart. So when we think about the Dow gold ratio, well, the Dow Jones is a relatively small index, and gold is no longer cash. So it made a lot of sense to look at the Dow gold ratio 100 years ago when the Dow was representative of the entire stock market and gold was money. So I think it is, in terms of the global petrodollar system, oil is more like money, and the NASDAQ is more representative of the asset or the portion of the stock market that has been doing best over the last decade. And we don't have as much back history as we do for the Dow Jones, or for the S&P for that matter. But we do see that there was a phenomenally big move in technology shares in the late 1990s. And then over the next decade, oil prices outperformed technology by a wide margin. And then over the course of the last 15 years, we had this phenomenal outperformance by energy, which peaked with oil prices basically going negative during the pandemic. And then subsequently, oil prices have outperformed. So now the question, of course, is this moving average, the 5-year moving average, is that now resistance? Are we going to see the technology sector underperforming the oil market? Now, that would be a secular trend change, and it would very clearly state that we're moving back into a commodity-led bull market, where there will be a lot more focus on things that come out of the ground and things that hurt when they fall on your foot, than the almost total focus on software and apps that we've had over the last few years. So we're at a, I think, a pivotal point in the global markets right now, because we're heading towards recessions. The playbook of the last 15 years has been to buy the dip whenever money supply increases. So people have been in acting in anticipation of that over the last 6 months, even though interest rates continue to rise. But the bet is that interest rates will come down hard, money supply growth will explode on the upside, and then we'll see asset price appreciation again. The counterpoint is that a lot of the buying in the cloud computing and in the technology sector has already happened in response to the pandemic, and that it will not happen as quickly again, and that rising interest rates are putting pressure on the subscription businesses. A lot of people are starting to look at how much they're paying for various services. And instead, there's going to be a lot more focus on the energy sector, on the infrastructure sector, and in manufacturing capacity as geopolitical tensions rise and as the war on the climate intensifies. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.